Hi, guys. Thank you so much for listening. Your support and comments mean everything to me. I wanted to share some exciting news. My original audio drama, The Nature of Dragons, is out now and available on most podcasting platforms. The link's in the description. Now onwards. Chapter 24. The day before the last battle, Voldemort wakes Draco himself. He sits on the edge of Draco's bed and brushes his fingers across his forehead. Draco blinks awake. Sunlight is streaming through his windows, framing Voldemort in its beams. Draco has to suppress the sound of distress that rises unbidden in his throat. "Isn't it a beautiful morning, little one?" asks Voldemort, lips spreading in a relaxed smile. "It is time for us to put those spectacular skills of yours to use." "I," breathes Draco, licking his lips, "what if I'm not strong enough?" "Oh, child," the man says gently, "of course you are. If I believe in you, how can you ever doubt yourself?" Voldemort gets to his feet, straightens his robes. "Go on then. Wash, dress, eat. I'll see you after breakfast." Draco nods, watches in silence as Voldemort leaves his bedroom, closing the door behind himself. He waits a moment, makes sure the man is truly gone, then turns, pressing his face into his pillow. His body quakes with silent sobs, his fists clenching at the covers. He stays that way, body quivering for another moment. Then he sits up on a sharp, barking exhale and pulls himself together. By the time he walks out of his room, he looks to all the world like an energetic young man, excited to take on the day. In the corridor, he runs into his mother. She takes one look at him and turns away. "I'm doing this for you," he wants to scream at her, retreating back. All this is... The dream shifts. "For you," Draco gasps, sitting bolt upright. Silver rain falls all around him. Each drop chimes as it hits the ground. Why would it chime? Why would it hit the ground around him? Harry's here. He's sitting on his lap, brushing his fingers over his brow, down the bridge of Draco's nose, examining him like one would examine a sculpture. Draco has to turn away from the sight of him. It's too much. The rain falling in shining silver streaks, framing Harry's face, lighting up his green eyes, illuminating the desire within them, and from beneath that desire, bringing out tenderness, care. How does one person care for another this much? Draco pulls away, even as Harry reaches for him, his fingers warm and soft on his cheek. Harry turns Draco's face back towards himself. "Draco!" Harry breathes. And there's such awe in his voice, such wonder, that Draco can feel tears well up in his eyes. "How can you look at me?" he wants to say. "How can you look at me like I'm this precious, fragile thing? After it all, after everything I've done." "Don't," he snaps instead. "Don't look at me like that." "You are mine to look at as I please," says Harry, and the softness of his tone belies the harshness of the words. "Do you know that you are wonderful? Do you?" Draco chokes out a sob, curls in on himself, hides. "Draco, you're not alone. I'm here now. Draco, I'm here." His vision blurs. Harry becomes translucent, ghost-like, melts right out of his arms. "Now." "Draco," his voice echoes. And all around Draco, the pitter-patter of silver rain. Pitter-patter, like little feet, of little feet. Little feet pitter-pattering around him. He blinks, trying to see in the half-light. He's on the ballroom floor of Zabini Manor. The rain is pitter-pattering around him through an enormous hole in the ceiling. Behind him, voices talk amongst themselves. He turns and sees Harry standing with Blaze, and Draco has to blink, rub his eyes to make sure that he's not seeing things. Three children. The eldest can't be more than 12. The youngest is what? 3? They're very small and painfully thin. Harry crouches in front of them, says something in that soothing tone of his. "You're not alone," Draco hears him say over the rain, and shudders. "We're here now." For a long moment, Draco just lays there, watching Harry extend a hand, touch the smallest child's sharp shoulder. Something twists in Draco's stomach. Harry will make an incredible father one day. Draco should give him the opportunity to become a parent, instead of tying him down with his broken self, capturing him inside of his broken life. Draco's heart starts beating faster. He groans, sits up, buries his face in his knees. He needs to collect himself. This is hardly the time for self-pity, hardly the time to let himself be overwhelmed by pain. Draco's whole body trembles, and he realizes that he's terribly cold. He reaches for his wand and freezes. It's gone. "I've got it right here," says Harry softly, placing a hand on Draco's shoulder. When had he approached? "Harry." Harry walks around him to kneel in front of Draco. "You can't use magic like that, Draco. You have to swear to me. You can't use that kind of magic. Forget about real-world repercussions like arrest in Azkaban. That kind of magic will eat away your soul." "Harry, I need you to swear, Draco. Harry starts to hyperventilate. "Isn't it enough? Everything I've been through, everything I've lost to dark magic, to evil? My family, my childhood, my soul? Are you going to make me lose you too?" "Harry," Draco tries to interrupt him again. "Swear to me. I need you to swear to me that you'll never use that spell again, no matter what." "Harry, I can't. Fucking swear to me." He's so loud that Blaze and the children jump, "or I will never speak to you again." Draco stares at him. This is it. This is his chance. One word, and Harry will be free of him for good. It's just one word. All he needs to say is, "I swear," says Draco. "I swear it, Harry." "Okay," Harry breathes out, rubs his hands over his face, still holding Draco's wand. "Okay, thank you. Here." He holds out the wand, and Draco takes it, shivering at the thrum of magic that rolls through his body at the contact. "Come on, you should meet the children." "Neighborhood kids?" asks Draco. "No," says Harry stiffly. "They're..." It turns out the story's pretty simple. Zane, Gretchen, and Tom were the children of Eleonora and Felix Fingleton, a plain but respectable Slytherin couple. Eleonora, Duran by birth, had been the eldest of three sisters. Not the prettiest, but thought to be the wisest. That is until she made the unfortunate decision to marry Felix Fingleton, a man with all the potential in the world and no idea how to use it. Still, the side-eyeing and harsh remarks that accompanied their union did accomplish one thing. They brought out in Felix an unquenchable urge to prove himself. So, of course, by the time Voldemort approached him to run his books, Felix was already primed and ready. He jumped at the opportunity. After the war, both Felix and Eleonora were sentenced to life in Azkaban, their possessions were confiscated by the Ministry, and their three children sent to the Little Snake House, an orphanage run by an old pureblood couple that had never had children of their own. When regulations started to tighten for Slytherins, the orphanage was shut down, and the 20-odd children that were being housed there were sent to whoever would take them in. The Fingleton children were given to their last surviving relative, Eleonora's youngest and most beautiful sister, a Slytherin herself, Isabella Duran. She was 4 months pregnant when the children arrived in her little attic apartment. For a little while, all had been well enough. Isabella worked long hours but was able to keep everyone clothed, fed. Soon, though, her pregnancy started to show, and her boss, who'd spent the best part of the last year trying to find a way to fire her, took the excuse and ran with it. Not long after that, she lost her apartment. She tried to apply for aid, but was, of course, denied. There were far more deserving candidates than the sister of the wife of a Death Eater. Knowing that the Zabini Manor was abandoned and untouched, Isabella brought the children here. That very night, her child was born. She was a tiny, sickly thing that Isabella named Annabelle. Isabella wasn't able to produce any milk, Harry says, so the baby died. Draco doesn't need to be told that Isabella died of grief. He can feel it in the magic permeating the manor. That final burst of her magic must have been what had wrapped the manor in the wards he, Harry, and Blaze had been trying to break through earlier that day. It reactivated the household spells, Harry says, the heating wards, the water supply, the small magical garden in the back of the house. It's how the children survived. How long have they been here? Draco asks. Hard to tell, says Blaze. A few weeks? A few months? Draco tries to keep the distress off his face. Do they have anywhere to go? He asks. Family? Harry shakes his head. They're all dead. They must have died in the war, Blaze says. Draco looks up at Potter, who's gone a little green around the edges. We need to bury Isabella and the baby, says Draco, rising, and then the kids will come and stay with Blaze and me in Malfoy Manor. The burial doesn't take long. The children don't cry, but they do huddle close. They seem hollowed out, empty and exhausted. She was a good woman, Blaze says finally. She did the best she could in the circumstances the world had given her. You guys didn't know her for very long, but I'm sure she loved the three of you dearly. She wouldn't be dead if it wasn't for us, says Tom, the eldest of the three children. A look of such profound sadness crosses over Blaze's face that Draco wonders if he's going to be the one to start crying. Do you really believe that? Blaze asks. Tom nods. Do you all believe that? Blaze asks Tom's siblings. The three children look down at their shoes, but eventually they all nod. If she wasn't forced to look after us, says Gretchen, she could have looked after herself. It was our job to take care of her, Tom adds, as the little one, Zane, sticks his thumb in his mouth and stands a little taller. That's not true, says Draco. It's the job of grown-ups to look after children, not the job of children to look after grown-ups. He watches Harry stiffen and turn away. Draco imagines this whole thing must be terribly hard on the man. Someone should have helped her, says Blaze, placing a comforting hand on Tom's shoulder. Someone should have helped all of you. You are not responsible for what happened here. Of course, thinks Draco, all this is upsetting Harry. His whole childhood was dedicated to looking after grown-ups. His innocence was sacrificed in order to protect the Wizarding World, when it was the Wizarding World that should have been protecting him. After the burial, they take a child each and apparate to Malfoy Manor. Draco expands and childproofs one of the bathrooms so that the kids can wash themselves. He puts in an order with Wizarding Delightful Deli deliveries and goes upstairs to find his old childhood clothing. He knows his mother had put the little robes and hats, shoes and shirts away for safekeeping in hopes that Draco's own children would wear them one day. How life turns, Draco thinks as he opens the trunks. His mother had once expected grandchildren. Now the best she can hope for is for Draco to visit her once every 10 years. Draco finds his old first-year robe, shakes it out. It's tiny. He had been so small. They had all been so small back then. Hadn't first year been the first time Harry had had to face down Voldemort? Harry had seemed so brilliant, so competent back then. But these robes, Merlin, these robes just demonstrate how little, how helpless Harry had really been. It would be like Draco marching down his stairs and announcing to little Tom that he was to face down Voldemort alone if he wanted to save the Wizarding World. Sickening. The whole thing was sickening. No wonder Harry's a mess. It's surprising that he's not doing worse, all things considered. He'd been told as a little boy that it was his responsibility to save every grown-up in his life. No wonder he's taken the results of the clean-up so close to heart. What must it have felt like for him, walking into Zabini Manor, seeing the results of his work, of the work of his colleagues, seeing the Fingleton children who found themselves in their predicament in no small part thanks to his best friend's handiwork, or at least that of his family. Draco shakes his head. This isn't the time to think about Harry. Right now the children need him. The little ones need to be Draco's priority, not the adults. When Draco comes downstairs, Harry is nowhere to be seen. "I gave Harry a sleeping charm," says Blaise, as he lays out the chicken and vegetables from Delightful Deli Deliveries onto plates for them and the children. "Potter isn't doing well, Draco." Draco nods, looks at Blaise. What strength of spirit must Blaise have to offer a sleeping charm to a man who's at least partly responsible for his parents' deaths? Draco places his hand onto Blaise's, and Blaise turns his hand over, weaving his fingers through Draco's. Squeezes. "We're clean now, Mr. Draco," comes Gretchen's voice from the bathroom, making Draco jump. Draco flicks his wand at the stack of robes he'd found in the attic. They pop out of existence. "Check the sink. There should be robes for the three of you there." He waits a moment, then calls, "Are they there?" and gets a muffled, "Yes, Mr. Draco," in response. "I don't know what to do with children," Draco says to Blaise. "You're doing just fine. I'm sure we'll figure it out for tonight, and tomorrow we can take them to Narcissa." "I didn't even think of taking the children to my mother," says Draco. Blaise shrugs, says, "The manor isn't the best place for them right now. They're traumatized. They'll need a lot of attention. You won't be able to give them that while you're building your committee." Draco opens his mouth to say that the committee's dead, but snaps it shut. How can he even consider turning back now, given what Zane, Tom, and Gretchen have been through? So instead, he nods. "You're right," says Draco, portioning out the salad and placing it beside the sandwiches on the plates. "It's a smart move, and they'll be happier there, especially for now." Blaise sighs, leaning against the kitchen sink. Draco glances at him. His movements are slow and stiff, as though each one hurts. "And how are you, given everything?" Draco asks quietly. "Are you doing okay?" "Me?" Blaise glances up at him as though surprised by the question. "I'm sure I'm fine." "I don't think you are," says Draco. "I don't think you can be, not after all that." "It's just brick and mortar, Draco." "It was your home," Draco counters. Blaise closes his eyes, says, "Not for a long time now. Not for a very long time." "No such thing as home." The smile Blaise gives him is both mocking and resigned, and it twists through Draco's gut like a knife. "Not for people like us." The children come out of the bathroom. Draco resizes the robes to fit them. "I found these for you," he says to the kids, pulling out three stuffed animals, a seal, a unicorn, and a dragon. "They were my favorite toys when I was your guys' age. They've been waiting a long time to play with children again." The kids look at the toys, hesitant and shy. "Do you think you guys can help me out and take them?" "Can I?" asks Zane, bouncing on his toes, but not moving forward without the approval of his older brother and sister. "Oh, can I please?" Tom and Gretchen exchange a look, and then Tom finally nods. Zane rushes towards the seal and takes it from Draco. He hugs the toy close, then throws his arms around Draco, hugging him too. "Oh," says Draco, all thoughts knocked out of him by the sheer sweetness of the hug. He glances up at Blaise, helpless, but Blaise just grins and shrugs. "Well?" Draco says, smiling at Tom and Gretchen, "are you two going to claim your toys, or are you just going to stand there?" Zane takes the dragon from Draco and carries it over to Gretchen. The little girl takes it, wide-eyed, then pulls it close, burying her face in the dragon's fluffy hide. "Thank you, Mr. Draco," she mutters. Draco walks up to her and squeezes her shoulder before crouching in front of Tom and holding out the unicorn to him. Tom rushes him, ignoring the unicorn entirely, and throws his arms around Draco's neck. "Thank you for saving us," he whispers. Draco nods, pats the child's hair gently. "You're safe now," he whispers. "You're all safe." How is he supposed to tell them that he's going to send them to Narcissa after this? The five of them sit down for dinner. Draco tells the children about the toys, the games he played with them as a child. It helps break some of the tension, and by the time Draco floats dessert into the room, they're all smiling. "Blaze and I are going to take you to my mother's home in the morning," Draco says midway through dessert. "You don't want us?" asks little Zane. Draco's hand grips his fork. What is he supposed to say to that? "Can't we stay with you, Mr. Draco?" Gretchen asks. Draco puts down his fork, gets up from the table, and goes around it, to kneel between Zane and Gretchen, moving her chair a little, so that Tom can see them too. "I want the three of you to stay with me so, so much. But I promised that you would be safe from now on, and in order for me to keep that promise, I need to make it safe for you to be here. For that, I need you to stay with my mother for just a little while." The children nod, but refuse to meet his eyes. "This is what's best for you guys," Blaze says. "If Draco didn't think so, he wouldn't be doing it." Draco sighs, frowns, then says, "Tell you what. I promise you that I will come to see you guys every single night before you go to sleep, until the day it's safe enough for you to come and stay here with me. How does that sound?" The children nod, and Draco exhales in relief. "All right then, let's go upstairs. I've transfigured some beds for you."